Welcome everyone to this installment of The Hum and the Silence. For this episode, I wanted to dip my toes back into Canadian UFO Report, which has become, I think, my favorite UFO journal. It's a very down-home journal. It feels, like, very close to the people. So, wanted to present you some more stories from it. This one, UFO Stalks Two Boys. January 5th, 1968 was a cloudless cold day. The temperature's hanging just above zero. Two teens, Tommy Banks, 15, and Errol Smythe, 17, both of Whitehorse, Yukon. They had gone out on their snowmobiles that afternoon, hitting the slopes of Gray's Mountain. Tommy Banks recalled, quote, "It was just beginning to get dark, and we had our lights on, though it was still clear enough to see everything. When we decided to start for home, Errol went first, and I was following close enough to see him all the time until we came to a small knoll, and for a few seconds I lost sight of him. As I went up the knoll, I felt a sort of heat, and when I got to the top, I saw a bright thing moving just over the trees slightly behind Errol. It seemed to be following him. Just then, Errol looked back, and he thought it was my light at first, and then he saw it too." End quote. When asked to draw a sketch of the object, Tommy drew an egg-shaped craft with two distinct bands of luminous color following the circumference of the object. The outside band was red, and the inside one was a yellowish-orange, and each of these light bands pulsated. The object itself measured about 10 feet by 20 feet. Quote, "I saw it for about 10 seconds before it disappeared over the trees, and I guess Errol saw it for a little less than that. When I felt the heat, it seemed to me that my skidoo was slowing down a bit. Maybe it was just because I was excited, but it definitely felt that way." End quote. 100 miles from Whitehorse, over Atlin Lake, a similar object was seen over the lake the night before. The old trapper town boasts few citizens, but the ones that were there saw the object, and a month later another egg-shaped object was sighted on the Alaska Highway by a highway surface crew. One of my favorite pieces of UFO art is a depiction of the second incident we're going to be talking about. It was done by Brian James, a Winnipeg, Manitoba artist who supplied many art pieces for Canadian UFO Report over the years. The art piece in question depicts a case known as the Rosedale Humanoids case. Depicted against a starry night, under a full moon, in a valley, is a strange craft, if you can call it that, with some beings inside and one outside that appears to be collecting samples. I'll include an image of this piece with the post, but to me, it's the UFO equivalent of Van Gogh's Starry Night. The Badlands of Alberta, Canada have a lunar feel to them. There is an emptiness to them, but within its beauty is unsurpassed as well. Equally fascinating are the people that choose to live in such areas. One such figure is Esther Clapetson, who shared a house with her brother Bill on the outskirts of Rosedale, Alberta. On June 7, 1971, their property would play host to a strange scene. Quote, "It was the night of the full moon, when I noticed a light coming through one of our windows. I couldn't see what it was all about, so I went around to the front of the house where there is a porch. With me was my old yellow dog named George. I was surprised when I got there to see a rectangular-shaped lighted object down on the ground near an intersection of two roads." End quote. This object was only 8 feet tall by 5 feet wide. The light itself was coming from the interior of this object, which illuminated part of the road nearby. The white opaque light illuminated three beings, two on the inside and another nearby who was engaged in a task across the road. They wore close-fitting uniforms of a drab green color and a face covering that fit tightly against the skin, also of a drab green color. There was a cloth-like covering obscuring the facial features, except for a pair of keyholes where the eyes would be. In a follow-up issue, more details would emerge. The beings were less than 5 feet tall, very thin, with thin wrists that led to pointed and padded mitts covering the hands. She noted no bends in the elbows and knees. Esther knew this object was of an unusual nature, and spurred on by a UFO broadcast by Bill Allen, looked for an instrument panel. Quote, "So the first thing I did was look for one, and I saw something that looked like a panel at the far end of the object. But one of the men, if that's what they were, seemed to have realized someone was looking at them, and he covered as much of the panel as he could by standing with his back against it and stretching out his arm. He continually kept looking backwards to see that his arm was covering whatever was in front of the craft." End quote. Esther watched as the crew members signaled to the other one inside the craft, who leaned out slightly to get the attention of the other being on the outside. Quote, "The man out there was obviously picking up samples. I guessed it was rock, not dirt, because he was picking, not scooping. After a moment, I tried to get closer and have a real eyeful, but the old dog wouldn't let me. He was scared to death, and he pushed me right back. That was quite a push, you've got to admit. Well, then, I came in, but to be honest, it wasn't that fussy about getting much closer to that thing. Anyway, I came in to attract my brother's attention. Then I looked through the window to see the object again and what they were doing. But there wasn't even the light. When I returned with my brother, there was nothing there. And so help me, I hadn't been drinking. I'm not a drinking woman." End quote. The next day, the Clappisons walked into the field to the spot where the craft had quote-unquote landed. The area left signs that it had been visited. At the edge of the road, a scorched imprint was found that was approximately 20 feet long and was in a vague rectangular shape. 4 months after the incident, the mark was still there. Over 4 months later, in Drumheller, Joe Klimek, a metal worker in the oil fields of Drumheller, was bringing his sister and brother-in-law out to the fields to a fossilized oyster bed when he came across a strange but kind of similar object. It was September 23rd, 1971, at around 4:30 p.m. Quote, "We had just driven out there when we saw an object on the opposite side of the canyon that I had never seen before. We kept looking at it, but there was no movement of any kind, so we drove down to the oil field at the bottom of the canyon to get a better look at it. But still, there seemed to be no movement." End quote. The object was bluish-gray, approximately 12 feet by 12 feet by 10 feet tall, with a pointed top that beveled on one side. Eventually, they all returned to the car, unable to examine the object more closely. The next day, Joe returned to the fossilized oyster bed. There was no sign of the object anywhere. Quote, "There is no way a thing of that size could have been lifted out of there without making a major operation. Even if a helicopter had managed to do it, there would have been tracks all over the place, getting the thing hitched up. But there was nothing like that at all. It didn't fly off under its own power. I don't see how it got away." End quote. Interestingly enough, there were some rather unusual tracks found in the area. As he climbed down into the coulee from the opposite side, Joe noticed 6 oval-shaped marks, each approximately 6 inches long, leading to a grassy bank above the ledge where they disappeared. They were evenly spaced about 30 inches apart and proceeded in a single-file line. Quote, "Klimek's impression was that they must have been made by someone climbing up the hill. This leaves us awkwardly trying to visualize someone with tiny club-like feet and the stride of a tall man firmly mounting that sharp incline with the precision of a tightrope walker." End quote. At the top of the cliff, Joe also found a small L-shaped brass rod that was pointed at one end and sawn straight through at the other, with saw marks clearly showing. It was an ordinary-looking bit of metal that might have been dropped by one of the oil workers. There's a picture of it that I'll be including with this post, so just check the images at the bottom. Flying cars. Here's a great story from the same issue involving a flying car. Perhaps because it is one of their favorite convention centers, flying saucer operators in West Alberta are given to supportive antics. True, mischief is part of the UFO occupant character, but in this particular area, their sense of fun is sometimes so boisterous it scares victims out of their wits. Ask Wilton Raw Eater and his wife, Rosalyn, of the Blackfoot Indian Reserve near Glycan. The date was May 14th, 1971. Quote, "I went to the bar and I had a few beers," Raw Eater said. "And then we started coming home. It was at night. Then, just up the hill, we passed a few houses and all of a sudden see this bright light. It hit us just like lightning on the right side of the car, a 1960 Pontiac Tudor. We went on a little way, and I didn't notice anything for a few seconds until the wife told me, 'The car's off the ground.' Well, I kept steering the car while we stayed on the side of the road. It didn't bother me. We went for about a quarter of a mile. I had the lights on. Then all of a sudden, the car hit the ground. I could feel the wheels when they hit. Then we drove home right away and went to my brother's place. We told his wife about it and waited for my brother and told him about it." End quote. Explaining points raised by Allen, Raw Eater said he did not really steer the car during the strange flight. He just held the wheel and the car stayed over the road. After his wife spoke, he could see through his wide window that they were in the air. Meanwhile, he said the speedometer showed 40 to 45 miles per hour. One might decide the whole experience could be traced to Raw Eater's few beers. His calm feeling as he floated along could suggest just a pleasant alcoholic mood, but to his wife, it was nothing of the sort. "At first, I didn't really care," she said. "I thought it was just the speed, because he was always speeds. But then I noticed it because we have rough roads and can feel the bumps. This was just like driving a new car, and your car isn't that new. But then I looked down, and our car was off the ground." Mrs. Raw Eater told Allen she thought the car was about 2 feet in the air. She didn't remember how long it lasted because she was too scared. Then she felt a bump and knew they were back on the road. You can always tell when you're on the roads we've got. They're real bad. The strange light went off just like that when they landed, she recalled. Quote, "Then I told him to drive a little faster because I wanted to get home to my kids. I thought that was the last time I was going to see them. It really scared me. So we took the kids in the car and I told him, 'Let's go over to your brother's.' That's when we went over to his brother's place." End quote. Mrs. Raw Eater's remarks about being scared was an understatement. She was so terrified by what happened that for 2 weeks she refused to go out in the car. If the notion persists that those beers are still the answer, consider the case of Mrs. Barbara Smythe, a school teacher at Craigmile, just 50 miles northeast of the Blackfoot Reservation. The date was February 18, 1969. Driving to school that morning, which she described as beautiful, Mrs. Smythe saw something above a hill to the right she couldn't believe. It was a gigantic, bright pink red thing with two layers, which was three times the size of a granary of 14 feet diameter. The object was revolving. It contained two huge flashing white lights and was surmounted by something like a tent with flames on top and sides going in and out. After driving a few hundred yards, the school teacher noticed the object had jumped abruptly to another hill, and simultaneously her car was floating along at about 20 miles per hour after she had shifted it into high gear at 30. Quote, "I didn't seem to be steering it," she told Allen, "or hit any bumps, and there was no noise, nothing. The car just seemed to keep on going down the road. I didn't seem to be able to get my foot off the gas and put it on the brake. I kept thinking, what if I meet somebody? But I didn't meet anybody. The car was floating along okay, so I looked back at the thing. I was so hypnotized by it. But as for the rest of my body, I'm sure it didn't move. When you're driving, your hands move a little bit, but mine didn't. I just sat like that, end quote. To establish that the silence around her was unnatural, which would help confirm the floating sensation, Alan asked Mrs. Smythe if she usually heard the sound of the car. "Oh, sure," she replied. "I hear the bumps, because it's bumpy out there. I steer through bits of ice and ruts and stuff. I just kept my hands in the same place, and the car just seemed to float along on the ground. It was horrible." Alan then asked how many times she looked at the object. "Well, I was more or less staring at it all the time. Maybe 3 minutes, but I wouldn't bet on it." After she had floated along to the end of a one-mile stretch of road, she saw the flashing object disappear behind the hill. Although she did not explicitly say so, presumably, at that moment, her weird experience ended. In any case, she moved on to school, driving normally. An incidental note of the interview was that at school, Mrs. Smythe had declared herself a non-believer in flying saucers. She came about a short time before when some of her pupils said their mothers had seen them. "Oh, it's impossible," she told them. "There is no such thing. It's just imagination." Then they argued with me, but my mother saw it. I said, "I don't care. There is no such thing." "But now I've seen one," she exclaimed. Continuing on with the theme of flying cars, this case was reported in Canadian UFO Report, but it occurred near Connersville, Indiana, in August of 1966. It was around 8 p.m. when Bobby Johnson, 11, actually his name was Bobby Dale Johnson, Tina Johnson, 10, and Gail Johnson, 8, were playing in their yard. It was Gail that first saw a strange light in the sky. "It looked like a great big star, and I knew it wasn't a star because it was too big. It started getting bigger. Then I turned around to tell Tina and Bobby Dale, and it had moved over there, closer. It had all these colors, like red and blue spots and some others. It tilted toward the ground, and I thought I heard a buzzing sound. I didn't look at it very long. I ran in the house, told my daddy, then watched out the window." Tina continues, "We were playing with our dogs in the front yard, and Gail yelled, 'Tina, come over here. I saw something in the sky.' First, I thought it was a star, so I started to say, 'Starlight, star bright.' And then it started to move. I was right under the thing and looked at it. It took up a pretty lot of space. It looked larger than our barn. It was really large. The object was just above the treetops and appeared to be tilting in her direction." Bobby Dale recounted, "I was down there under the tree messing around with my dogs, and I looked up because Tina and Gail were hollering and carrying on. It was pretty big. I thought it would cover the whole house and barn, too. I didn't hear it make any noise because my dogs were barking and making such a racket. Then a kind of plate opened up, big, wide. It looked like a porthole, and there were two metal pieces, and there was a little one in the middle, and it just slid open. Then a big beam shot down, kind of whitish-orange. It went down north of town real fast and came back up. I saw it go down over the hill, and I heard the dogs barking and turned to see what they were doing, and then I saw it coming up. It was about 30 seconds. Then it came back up, and it had an object in it." Bobby Dale had the impression that the city lights, which were visible nearby, brightened briefly as the beam of light moved beyond the nearby trees. "It just looked like you had a helicopter and hooked onto a station wagon or something like that and just took it right up. It looked like some kind of car or something. It went right over my head, almost above the trees, and it looked pretty good-sized. Then I got smaller when it got near the spaceship. It looked like a little car." Tina corroborated all this. "After that, it went real slow moving up. And then I saw something moving in it. And I said to Bobby Dale, 'What was that?' And he said, 'It looks like a little car.' And then the door shut and it took off. It scared me half to death. It really looked like a car going up to me. It looked bigger when it was going up. As I got farther to the object, it got smaller. It looked real small then." Tina was able to see something going on inside the dome of the object. It looked like real thick glass. I was looking up at the bottom, and I kind of went back, and I could see right through the dome and see the stars up on through it. There was something looking out at me. Her brother didn't believe her for a second and expressed that while she was being interviewed. "That's the truth, Bobby Dale. It really is." Then her father called her out for lying. "I am not, Dad, honestly. It was dark, and I couldn't describe it, really. But it was just like it had a nose and everything. I could see enough that it looked like a human being, only it was scaly, like skin scaling off. Scaly and dark. That's the honest truth. I'm not lying. I'm not lying." There was something on its face I can't describe. I haven't seen anything like it in the whole world. I looked at its head, and I could see the eyes just a real little bit. They were red. Real little, you know. And they were bright red. Only one arm was a little longer than the other, it looked like to me, because they were holding their arms like... Yes, there were two of them in there. They looked like their arms were a little shorter, about like that. Here, Tina gestured, trying to show what she meant. In a later interview, Worley asked how she could see one arm was shorter than the other. Tina replied the occupants held their arms out for some reason, and she noticed a difference in length. She said they also pushed buttons, just like us. As the object departed, both Bobby Dale and Tina remembered certain different aspects as it left. From Bobby Dale, "Right before it started to leave, our cat was kind of wobbly. He fell off a branch out of a tree. He fell on his side. When he came back, he had a sore hip. Remember, Mother? He acted kind of funny, like he was having a stroke and fell down once running away. He didn't come back up until the next day." Tina recounted, "I got behind Bobby Dale, who ran when he saw his sister fall, and looked. It didn't move on. It just disappeared. I watched it real close, and it just disappeared. After a while, I heard this sound, a real high-pitched sound. Now, when I get to thinking about them in bed with Gail and put my head under the cover..." Such an innocent, great story. Now we move on to an agile humanoid. On October 7th, 1975, Robert A. Suffren of Uterson, Ontario, had a strange encounter with a strange humanoid. A report was eventually made to Ontario Provincial Police, and this is what was in the report. "At about 8:30 p.m. tonight, I got a phone call from my sister Shirley, who lives about 300 yards northeast of my house. She said it looked like a fire at my barn. I went out, and at first I couldn't see anything, but then I heard the cattle rustling, but told my sister I couldn't go out because I was looking after the baby. She came down to the house, and I took her car and went to the barn and saw nothing. I went out to the lane and drove down the road and turned down a side road. Then I saw the ship in the center of the road. It was the color of the dull side of aluminum foil wrap, and the surface was irregular and crinkled. I could not hear any sound other than the motor of my car. I only saw it momentarily, and then it went straight up at a fast speed and disappeared. There were no lights. I turned around and started for home. Turned onto the 3 mile lake road, and then I saw the thing on the side of the road. It was on the grass shoulder of the road and was about to cross from my right to my left. It suddenly pivoted, turned towards the pasture, and vaulted over the fence and out of sight. It appeared to be short and had very broad shoulders, which seemed to be out of proportion. The movements were similar to an ape or a midget, but it was very agile. It reached up with its hand, grabbed the fence post, and vaulted over with no effort. The head portion was covered in a globe, and I couldn't detect any mask or face portion. The suit was a silver color in one piece. The globe was a contrasting white or light color. I returned home and had time to get the kids to bed. The TV was on, and suddenly the sound stopped, and when I looked, it blacked out for a matter of seconds. I went to the door, and out behind the barn in the pasture, I saw an orange fluorescent light that was not flashing. The light seemed to follow the contour of the land headed out over 3 Mile Lake. I debated for some time who to call, and then I called the OPP in Bracebridge. About 10 years ago, in the same area, I saw a similar ship in flight over my barn. Investigator Henry H. McKay interviewed the witness and obtained further details about the craft. He estimated the size as 8 to 9 feet top to bottom and a width of approximately 12 to 14 feet. The ship appeared to look like the dull side of aluminum foil, wrinkled and displayed a narrow dark band around the edge of the clam-like portion of the structure. He indicated the ship had rested on or close to the graveled road surface. Robert Suffren engaged in the building trade as a carpenter and would be familiar with aluminum foil for its insulation qualities and a good judge for estimating the relevant dimensions. And now we move on to a very interesting case that is that has voices associated with it. A tobacco farmer named Joseph Borda of Mount Pleasant, Ontario, was walking from the house to a barn on his mother's farm when he spotted a shiny domed metallic object sitting in the tobacco field. He first thought that this was a flying saucer, but a few moments later he said to himself, "No, that's a tank truck." This was curious because he's not exactly sure where the thought came from, but he glanced at the object a few more times before completely dismissing it from his mind entirely. 2 days later, on Tuesday morning, he went into the tobacco fields with a cultivator and began to feel hot and off. He quit early that day, around 11 a.m., and went home, claiming that he wasn't feeling very well. After lunch, he went back out around 1:30 p.m. and found a large circular crushed patch of tobacco plants 30 to 40 feet in diameter, and then it dawned on him. It was a true UFO. Left behind was a couple spots of a substance that was reddish purple and very oily. Quote, later on, Douglas Lucas, director of the Forensic Science Center, said that the analysis showed that the sample comprised tobacco and soil and was not radioactive and did not contain oil. He said that this was the police had asked the center to check on it. Staff Sergeant Bud Sorka, head of Brantford's police department, recalled that the sample looked just like a sponge but felt somewhat firmer. Examination of plants within the area showed that it contained a reddish-brown streak down the center. However, it could not be established if this was due to the effects of from the UFO's landing or whether the irregularity was presented beforehand. End quote. After his story went public, Joe received a phone call from investigators, and he agreed to escort them out to the landing area. Before long, they started to hear what sounded like a transistor radio. They stopped, trying to hear the voice, but it ceased when they stopped talking. It resumed again once their conversation did, but it was unmistakable, the sound of a woman's voice. Quote, after about 3 minutes of this, something seemed to take control of Joe's mind and told him to return to the house. Although admitting to not feeling scared, he simply said, "I'm not staying here anymore." Turned and walked with the Canadian investigator to the car. End quote. That's just a fun story. Like, UFO. I'm not a UFO. Don't worry about it. I'm just a tank truck. I love this story because it's like the words flying alligator skin. I don't know what kind of images they evoke in your mind, but, I remember running across this article quite a while ago, and the associated image with it is really spectacular. You definitely want to check it out in the show notes. In January of 1977, Kirk Allure, a grocery store employee, was driving on a highway near Prince George, BC. Now, Prince George, if you remember, is where the first abduction story was reported in their newspaper, The Citizen. Here on the highway near Prince George, British Columbia, when a large illuminated craft came into view. Quote, I came up a corner on the way from Prince George and noticed a red light about a mile away. to my right, above some hydro towers. I just kept driving on and looking at it, and then I saw a car coming. He was about half a mile away. Then I noticed this red light move. I kept staring at it, and it just sort of shot right over the top of the oncoming car. I just stared at it in amazement. Then it shot towards me, when the oncoming car was about 300 yards away, and it was huge. It took up about two highway widths, and at that instant, the red light up the interior of my cab, and I got a strange sensation, like my arms were falling asleep, and my legs felt asleep, and they felt like pins and needles. Then I swerved and missed this thing because it was coming right towards me. It all happened so fast, I just don't remember anything after. I sort of blacked out, I guess. According to our watches, it was 15 minutes later or so, making it about 4:30 a.m., and this guy was opening my door and shaking me. He was asking if I was all right. I said, yes, I'm okay, I guess. But I was sort of sick at the moment and was aching all over. My arms and everything were sore. Our cars were about 2 feet apart. He said, a strange thing happened to me. I was outside my car when I came to. We could find no skid marks, and I was doing at least 70 miles an hour when I swerved into his lane. We went to the hospital in Vanderhoof, both of us, and they checked us over, and there was apparently just shock. That's all it was. I never did get the other guy's name. When asked for a description of the craft, Kirk offered this. Quote, it was oblong. The outer shell looked more or less like alligator skin. It had little protruding wings, except they were rounded. Underneath, between the wings, it had a circular thing, like an electric razor. You know, the discs, that's what it had underneath, one turning slowly inside the other, which was turning the other way. It had a dome on top with different colored lights inside, green, red, yellow, blue, all like little dots. Then it had just one straight beam of red light when it shone the red light in my truck, end quote. Now, this report, or this article, refers to a being known as Big Head. Big Head is a fixture of Ohio. There's a great sketch that I ran across a while ago. I don't know if it's one that I... No. If I run across it, I'll put it in with the... images of the episode comparing Big Head to Mothman, and it's a brilliant, brilliant image. But I'm going to quote this article verbatim here. What has a head larger than its body, bulging red eyes, and stands over 7 feet tall? That was the question that the Dispatch of Columbia, Ohio, asked its readers last July in reporting the appearance of a monster seen in several parts of the state. According to police, there were 3 or 4 confirmed sightings in the single area of Richland County, with unexplained imprints left on the ground where the creature allegedly was seen. More details were provided by the News Journal of Mansfield, Ohio, which said witnesses described the creature as standing nearly 7 to 9 feet tall with red bulging eyes and a head as wide as a tractor tire. According to the report, 2 of the witnesses were teenage boys who became alarmed one night when they heard rustling noises beside the railway tracks where they were walking. The boys pointed a flashlight beam in the direction of the noise and saw what they described as a large dark mass with a head much bigger than its body. Although monsters seen dimly at night are not likely to justify more than local attention, we think these Ohio reports merit something more because of one detail, the reference to a big head. Compared to Bigfoot as a monster in the news, Big Head is a nobody. Yet he is not completely unknown, and he is capable of making an even more singular impression when he does appear. In fact, when we read about the Ohio cases, we were reminded of a Big Head item we had seen weeks before. Though fairly brief and with nothing to support it except the witness's own words, it made the sort of impact that lingers. Moreover, in this case, there was the added interest of an unusual flying machine being described. Contained in the article on the UFO invasion of Antarctica, Ideals UFO Magazine, number 2, June 1978, New York, the item reported the frightening experience of a U.S. serviceman, Roger D. Benson, in Antarctica in December 1958. Benson was operating a tractor towing vehicle out of the research station at McMurdo Sound when he spotted an unusual-looking object in the distance. Quote, "There wasn't supposed to be anything there," he later said. "I was curious. I radioed base that I was dismounting from my vehicle, dropped to the ice, and took a closer look. At first, I thought I was looking at some object with a lot of girder work, like an observation tower or a giant radar antenna. I peered through binoculars. I was seeing what resembled a side view of an airplane fuselage, and the girders were a lattice of supporting structures, which must have been the landing gear. The fuselage was a cigar-shaped cocoon of metal with a small indentation that might have been a door. The whole thing appeared to be about 500 yards from me, which would have made it about the size of a DC-3 plane. But I'm thoroughly familiar with aircraft, and it wasn't any plane that belonged to us or the Russians. Then I saw the creature." Benson shivered with apprehension. Beneath the parked object, a creature with semi-human characteristics walked in slow circles. He was very thin and grayish in color. His arms dangled all the way to the ice. From the distance, I couldn't be sure, but he seemed to have man-like facial characteristics, except that his face consumed almost two-thirds of an entire height. I'm ashamed to say now, I did exactly what I'd been trained not to do. I panicked. I leaped into my vehicle, started back toward the base, and shouted into the radio. After a few minutes, I got control of myself enough to look back. The fuselage cocoon, minus its girder-like landing gear, which might have been retracted, was now climbing into the air. I halted long enough to watch it fly away, presumably with that strange creature inside. End quote. Benson's sighting occurred during a scientific expedition called Operation Deep Freeze, the second of its kind, led by U.S. Rear Admiral George J. Duffick. Although Benson was alone in that case, UFO activity became so pronounced while the expedition was underway that Admiral Duffick was later cornered for an interview. He did not brush off the subject, as an officer in his position might have. "I think," he said, "that the existence of flying saucers cannot be discounted." So, Big Head. Big Head is a pretty, like, nobody talks about Big Head. Nobody. And it's a shame, because somebody should be talking about Big Head. Because the sketch of Big Head is pretty fucking amazing. But I did find the image comparing Big Head and Mothman, and I will be adding, it to the doc. Sorry, I've been vamping here, very briefly, but, yeah, it's, you know, Big Head's interesting. And quite frankly, if I could do more on Big Head, I would. So, this is the final story. Humanoids over West. Dawn Smith, 9 years old at the time of her eerie experience here early last November, was awakened about 6 that morning as her mother started her car to go to work. Her mother's departure meant that Dawn would be alone for a while in their house near West Bank on Lake Okanagan, British Columbia. Since the house is somewhat isolated on top of a hill, with only a vineyard nearby, it was a position that any other young girl might have fussed about. But Dawn is bright and self-reliant, and, as usual when her mother left, she snuggled in her bed for a little more sleep. This, however, was not to be one of those unusual times, for something very strange outside her window, against the still dark sky, caught her eye. I saw a big light in the sky and a little one moving up and down beside it, she told Alan. The big light was like a shoebox, and it had green lights down one side. The other light was white, and it was swaying as it went up and down. It stopped for a while, and then it went up and down again. Then the shoebox opened a door, like a garage door, and the little light went inside. Under careful questioning by Alan, Dawn explained the shoebox was smaller than half the size of a full moon, and she was looking up at it at an angle of 45 degrees. She said that besides the green light down one side, it had an outline of red lights. Those across the top were particularly noticeable. The door closed, Dawn continued, and the shoebox went behind a rain cloud, but I could still see it because the cloud only half covered it. Then it came back out, opened the door again, and the flying saucer came out. When it went in, it was just a little round light, and when it came out, it was like a flying saucer with lights going around it. They were red, yellow, and orange. It had a little hook on top. Before going to see Dawn with his wife Yvonne, Alan listened to some of her account over the phone. But the visit itself produced more surprising information, and the Allens decided that this was because the young witness was less nervous than at first, and so more willing to recall what had happened. For one thing, the description of a flying saucer emerging from the larger object was new to them, and they were impressed by the girl's earnestness in trying to remember if the rim lights were revolving around the saucer, or if the whole craft was turning. Dawn also said that the door of the first object opened, she saw two figures like guards standing in the dim light on the interior, because she had difficulty in describing what they were like, saying they were like a person, but it was dark, Alan suggested. They may have been wearing dark uniforms, and Dawn seemed to agree. After the saucer left the shoebox, Dawn overcame her fear sufficiently to leave her bed and go to the window for a better view of what was going on. But she was too late. It was getting light, and the lights were gone, she said. I phoned my friend Sandy, who later said Dawn sounded very frightened. I was scared because I didn't know what that thing was. I thought it was going to come down and get me. It was halfway down to my house, and I thought it was looking at me. Helpfully for his visit, Alan, who thought the girl showed courage in saying anything at all about her experience, had with him the tape of an interview recorded just a few days earlier in which another humanoid sighting was described. The witness was Stuart Sanborn of nearby Winfield. His mature account of his own experience, which Alan replayed for Dawn's benefit, not only had a reassuring effect on the girl, but also had the incidental benefit of persuading Mrs. Smith that her daughter was telling the truth. In particular, Mrs. Smith had wondered about the part where Dawn described a door opening and figures becoming visible inside. But that part was put in a new and more convincing light when it turned out that Sanborn had seen something similar. Sanborn said he was driving north just beyond Lake Okanagan one autumn evening in 1975 when he had his first hint of strange things to come. I noticed something peculiar in the sky, he explained. Whether the sun was shining on it or it had a light of its own, I'm not sure. But it was unusual, whatever it was. It attracted my attention. In the next moment, Sanborn lost sight of the object when it disappeared behind hills that skirt the lake. And at that point, a less attentive witness might have lost interest. But previous encounters had convinced Sanborn that occasionally there were strange sights in the sky worth watching. Of these, the most notable occurred in 1952 when he and others saw an unexplainable saucer-like craft take flight from that same lake, Volume 1, Number 4, Page 5. So, now alert to what he had seen, Sanborn kept an eye out, and in a few minutes was rewarded by a dramatic aerial show. I was approaching Kamloops, he said. I noticed two lights, one red and one green, about 30 feet apart. They were moving slowly, and then they nearly stopped, if they didn't stop completely. After a moment, a light came on, and I saw what appeared to be a cabin between the lights. A door opened, and I saw what looked like a man jumping out. On his head was a horseshoe-shaped gear consisting of red and green lights. He went down about 50 feet, and then the lights went out, and the machine started off again. Veering to the left at quite a hasty speed, there was no sign of a parachute, and the figure descended at a falling speed. Intrigued by the sight of a figure dropping like a dead weight into the evening shadows, Sanborn later inquired if there had been flying activity of any sort around there at that time. As far as he could learn, there was none. And that's going to do it for this installment of The Hum in the Silence. Thank y'all so much for supporting us and listening. Special thanks to Floats for the use of their song UFO as our theme. To Megan Lagerberg for our logo, the great Desdemona, Spencer Worth Davis, to everybody. Thank you so much. And I'll be talking to you soon.